So I can remember as a child, hippies, and there was a lot of talk about LSD and various psychedelics. But then it seemed to go really fairly quiet. I mean, I was born in 57, so I'm probably talking about the 60s. I had this peripheral awareness of this. Mm-hmm. And looking back, well, being reminded from your book, there were some pretty successful psychedelics being used in psychiatry in the late 40s, early 50s. Certainly a lot in the late 50s.
In the late 50s, yes. I mean, I think it was about 53 that Sandoz made available LSD for research, particularly in psychiatry. And I think in 57, the famous man, Albert Hofmann, who discovered LSD, he made LSD. He then got access to magic mushrooms and then worked out that the active ingredient in magic mushrooms was called psilocybin. And Sandoz made that available. It was called indocybin. So there were basically two medicines. LSD was called Delicid, and psilocybin was called indocybin. And they made it available to researchers in most Western countries, in fact. And in those days, there weren't any psychiatric treatments. The drugs you mentioned earlier, chlorpromazine, wasn't really being rolled out to the late 50s, and imipramine and antidepressants later. So these drugs were the first true treatments in psychiatry, and psychiatrists thought they were really very, very powerful and effective. But then they moved out of medicine into what you alluded to, sort of became part of the hippie culture. And the hippie culture was anti the Vietnam War. Mm. And the American government was very pro the Vietnam War. And when hippies were putting up placards saying, "Drop acid, not bombs," that was seen as a terrifying threat to the U.S. establishment. And they couldn't ban protests, but they could ban the drugs. So they banned the drug. They banned LSD. And then he thought, well, there's other drugs like LSD, psilocybin, DMT, we'll ban those. So even though there was no suggestion that these were about either harmful or even fueling protests. So the drugs got banned by the U.S. in 1968. We followed suit, as we always do, when the Americans say, "Jump, you say, oh, hi, sir." And then in 71, the U.N. banned them, and they're still banned. They've been banned ever since. Yeah. It's impossible to work with them. And I think that's the worst censorship of research and clinical therapy in the history of the world. 55 years, drugs which could transform people's lives for depression, PTSD, addictions, they've been banned simply because the American government thought they were actually fueling an anti-war protest.
Our generation, isn't it? You think of the mental distress I've had in times in my life, could that have been attenuated, ameliorated? You know, mental distress I've seen in those around me.
Very likely, John. I think that's a very important point to make, that I'll make it in slightly different ways. But it wasn't just that these drugs were the first psychiatric medicines. They were also powerful and enduring. So, you know, you didn't need many, you know, one or two trips could give you a very, very long-lasting effect, maybe a lifetime. And then, of course, there's the other ways of using them. So Hofmann lived to 102, and he used what we would call a sort of mini or a micro dose of LSD on a regular basis to keep his brain active and functioning. And the first British psychiatrist to use LSD was a man called Joel Elkies. He was professor in Birmingham in 1953, and he took LSD, and he wrote about the experience and said, "I think I know how it works." And he lived to 103. So it's quite possible that if we use these drugs sensibly, like the early guys did, they could have given us resilience and longevity too, as well as help treating mental illness.
Yeah. What are the main? I mean, what is a how do we define the term psychedelic? I mean, has it got a precise meaning, or is it?
So the term psychedelic, there was a lot of debate in the famous. The writer who made the term psychedelics known, and he helped coin the term. It wasn't his term, though, actually. Was obviously Aldous Huxley. And he and a guy called Humphrey Osmond. Humphrey Osmond was a British psychiatrist who couldn't get a job in in Britain, or at least couldn't get a job that paid well enough. So he went off to I think, Winnipeg, you know, in the middle of the Canadian plains, where they were desperate for British doctors. But he started using LSD as a treatment, and he was the person who actually gave LSD to Huxley, because Huxley's writings, first writings, actually, from mescaline, not from LSD, which is a cactus-derived. Yeah. And they what are we going to call this? And I think Huxley said, oh, what about Farath? Enthymome or something, I don't even know how to say it. I think Osmond said, no, that's not going to catch on. And he said, what about this work, psychedelic, from the Greek mind manifesting? And that's what, basically, what's a psychedelic? Something that helps you understand your mind better.
So the particular compounds, we've mentioned psilocybin, that's from mushrooms.
Magic.
We've mentioned LSD, lysergic acid, methylamide. Yes. That's purely chemically synthesized, isn't it?
Ah, not originally, no.
Oh, right, okay.
So Hoffman, here's a tale. This actually, many of your listeners may not know this. So nature makes a thing called lysergic acid, right?
I didn't know that, right?
Yeah, various fungi make lysergic acid. The ancient Greeks knew about it. The ancient Greeks knew that when ergot, the fungus grew on the cereal crops. In fact, the ancient Greeks thought the main purpose of cereals was not to make bread, but to eventually, in autumn, when you had dew, the fungus would grow. And they see these black things growing. Great, that's now the rye has matured. They take the ergot, dissolve it in wine, and make a drink called the kikion, which is a kind of psychedelic drink. And they loved that. It fueled many of their celebrations, which were called the Eleusinian Mysteries, for about 1,500 years. In fact, they were so popular that the Romans, when they took over Greece, thought, the high-level Romans said, we like this too. So the Romans allowed them to carry on, because the Romans just took part in it. It was part of a festival. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so but then in medieval times, people still knew there was a value, even though they weren't making the drink, there was a value to ergot. And the knowledge of ergot was held by women, because they knew that ergot, which contains lysergic acid and other ergots called ergotamine, could be used to help women stop bleeding after they've given birth. It constricts the uterus. And we still use it today for that effect. And so these women were using ergot, but people knew that ergot itself could be slightly psychedelic or hallucinogenic. And that's one of the reasons women got persecuted, because they were using these slightly hallucinogenic substances. They were treated as witches and then persecuted. My own view is it was actually a significant desire by the male medics to eliminate competition and to actually, you know, it's part of the usual hostility to women. But ergotamine still exists. And what happened, what Hoffman and his boss, they worked out what ergot was. They got the chemical structure. Then they worked out how to use it and make molecules. And then what Hoffman was trying to do was make a version of ergotamine or lysergic acid, which you couldn't patent because they were known. He was trying to make, as most drug companies have done ever since they took willow bark and turned it into aspirin, take a natural molecule, make a conversion, patent it, make lots of money. And intriguingly, I suppose thankfully, he discovered when he took the lysergic acid and put on these couple of ethyl groups to an amide link, it was very different to anything he tried before. And so that's how LSD was discovered. Yeah.
Interesting.
So you can make it from natural products, adding those diethylamides, or I don't know whether they make it purely synthetically. I don't know.
Mm. But it's copying nature, isn't it? It's copying natural molecules.
Yes, that's one of the ways we often describe this new field of medicine. It's sort of plant-based or natural medicines as opposed to synthetic medicine. Mm. But so you have to be clear, the regulations make it virtually impossible. We could not study natural mushrooms or natural DMT. You know, the current regulations make it virtually impossible for us to study those natural products in the UK because everyone's so obsessed with purity rather than value. Well, the regulators are anyway.
Yeah, that's interesting. This is the sort of dichotomy, as it were, between pharmaceuticals and herbalism, isn't it? In pharmacy, you aim for one molecule of a very precise known amount with a very precise defined purity and structure, which is fine. But in herbalism, you've got of a wide variety of molecules that might interact, that might inhibit, that might synergize, that might potentiate.
Exactly.
It's harder to control the dose. But I have come across people locally who actually have acquired quite a high level of expertise in psychedelic mushrooms. They are aware that you can dry it, that you can wear it out, weigh it out. They know the effect a particular dose will have,
exactly.
And it does seem to have a level of predictability. Now, of course, we're not condoning that. That's illegal. These are Class A drugs at the moment. But surely you're one of the you are the most senior psychopharmacologist in the country, a very experienced psychiatrist. Obviously, you can prescribe whatever you like.
Well, obviously, I can. The reality.
Or does the nanny state get in the way?
Well, I mean, you know, the worst, as I said, the worst example of censorship of medicine is the censorship of psychedelics, because not when they were banned. I mean, this was it was cynical and cruel.
Yeah.
The ban wasn't just to stop people taking it recreationally and protesting the war. They said that they were banned because they were very dangerous, and so they were put into Schedule 1 of the British and UN conventions. And Schedule 1 says no medical value, which was absolutely, I mean, you know, the 1,000 papers, no medical value, because we don't want it to be medical value. They said they were very dangerous when, you know, you've got 40,000 patients have been treated. I mean, no, as far as we saw, very few harms. In fact, remarkably, even in people who have disorders that we today wouldn't try them in, people with psychosis, they didn't seem to cause a lot of harm. And they were addictive when there were papers published showing they were anti-addictive. So this was basically just complete dishonesty. They thought these drugs were so politically challenging, they wanted to eliminate all knowledge of them. And they almost succeeded. In the 60s, the 70s and 80s, there was almost, you know, there was almost no publications on these drugs, but then event now, my group and others have started to bring them back because, partly because of the reasons we've got no innovation, and partly because the science of them is so fascinating, because they do reveal the mind as well and the brain as well as the mind when you do studies on them.